51 degrees Racine, 52 this morning in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have been devouring an extraordinary memoir by an extraordinarily gifted composer by the name of Ricky Ian Gordon. And anybody who is acquainted with the current musical theater and opera scene knows the name of Ricky Ian Gordon very, very well. He is the composer of a whole host of amazing songs that have been sung by the likes of Audra McDonald and Kelly O'Hara and Renee Fleming, Christine Chenoweth, and many, many more. The writer of some of the most compelling new operas on the stage. And now also the author of a thrillingly honest and open memoir called Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera, in which Ricky Ian Gordon looks back on his life, including those chapters most tumultuous, and really shares with us in an exceptionally open way his life as a human being and as an artist, and the way in which some of the travails that he has endured in his personal life have also been very much part of who he is as a composer, as a voice, as a singer. And it is a memoir that I highly recommend to anybody who is interested in what it is to be a musician in the modern world, especially to be a composer, to shape brand new works for the world and to try to say something significant. The book is published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. It's again titled Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs and Opera. And Ricky Ian Gordon, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
I'm very, very excited and honored to be speaking with you. I want to begin with kind of an overarching question, something that you say about a third of the way through the book, when you say, for most of my life, I have been prone to obsessions. I wonder, as you've gone through the experience of penning this memoir and looking over your life and reflecting on its many chapters, if you've sort of come to an understanding of why that is. What is that tendency for you to be obsessed with various things, sometimes various people and so on? From what do you think that stems?
Well, I've tried to make peace, Greg, with that fact. And what I sort of decided a few years ago, I was the commencement speaker at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And I was trying to think, what is it? And I just decided that the things we are irrepressibly drawn to, that no one tells us to like and no one tells us not to like, are what make us who we are. And I don't really... The truth is, Greg, everyone in my family was like that. Very powerful personalities, mercurial, moody, and intelligent in their own way. And I just think I had something irrepressible in me that no one was able to tame. And at this point, being past most of the excruciating pain, in the end, I'm glad for having that quality because I think what it gave me was a vocabulary. A vocabulary as a composer, a vocabulary as a poet, a vocabulary as a writer. It was all born out of, I guess in some ways, I'm grateful for, I think I had good taste. I had good taste in what I was obsessed with. Not necessarily the drinking, the drugs, the men, the sex, but, you know, as Charlie Parker says, if you don't live it, you don't blow it out your horn. So to be on the other side of all of that, which, of course, I never in a million years could have written that memoir if I wasn't on the other side, I just feel now like, you know, one time Anita O'Day was being interviewed on the Today Show by Bryant Gumbel, and he asked her the most, in a way, an obscene question. He was like, Anita, you've been a jazz singer, you've been a prostitute, you've been a drug addict, you've been, it was a litany of things she has been. And when he was done, he said, what do you have to say for yourself? And she said, that's what went down, Bryant. And I guess that's it, Greg. That's what went down. You know, I just, and I don't even, like, I say in the book, I mean, I was like a little boy when I was obsessed with Ingmar Bergman. You know, it just, who knows where that stuff comes from? Hmm. Sometimes I, you know, I do believe in reincarnation. And I was pretty weird and freaky from an early age in terms of my interests. Sometimes I think I've just been here before.
One of the things I also want to ask you in terms of kind of an overarching question about the book itself, which was written at least at part during that enforced hiatus for so many of us in the performing arts during COVID, is I've interviewed quite a few authors of memoirs over the years doing this program, and more than once somebody has sort of talked about how their memoir became, in a sense, much more transparent, much more honest and frank than they intended at the outset, that it was almost something that took on a life of its own. And I'm not sure I've ever read a memoir more open and transparent and honest than yours. I wonder, from the very outset, was that your conscious intention to be this open about so many aspects of your life, including some of your deepest frailties and vulnerabilities, or did the need to be honest and transparent sort of overtake you in a sense?
Well, that's such a great question. You know, Greg, the thing is, there's a sort of multiplicitous answer to that question, but it starts with, obviously, that we were quarantined, and on some level, it felt like the whole world was closed for business, right? And I remember I would go out, we have this little house upstate on a lake, and I would take the dog out and look up at the sky with the stars and the snow and think, nobody is doing anything more important than me at this moment. Like, everybody's just trying to figure out how to get through this period. And so I had a sense of safety. And I remember during the time I read this book by Stephen King on writing, and he says, write with the door closed, edit with the door open. But the thing was, the door was closed the entire time I was writing it. So I wrote with the door closed, edited with the door closed, and it was published with the door closed. And what I can say about that is this, Greg, I was tired of music. I needed to do something else. So many things had been postponed. You know, I was about to open my opera at Lincoln Center, Intimate Apparel. I was about to open Garden of the Finzi Continis for New York City Opera. I just had so much that suddenly just stopped, like somebody turned the faucet off. And I was like, I need to do something different. So I had this sort of idea of starting a writing group because I just wanted to explore another side of my brain for a little while. Not that I haven't written before, but definitely not prose. And because of what I do in the world, I happen to have a lot of really talented friends, writers, you know, poet laureates. I mean, the group was like Marie Howe, who was the poet laureate of New York, Nick Flynn, Donna Messini, Victoria Riddell, Marty Moran, Michael Klein. I mean, there were major writers in that group. And I just thought, I love those people, and I admire them. And I thought, I want them to love me. I want them to know who I am, and I'm not going to bowl them over as a stylist. You know, it's not going to be like, oh, my God, every sentence he writes is beautiful. At least I didn't think that at that moment. So I thought, my experiment in this writing group, since I trust them, is I am going to see how deeply I could allow myself to be known. And I started from that premise, and it was scary, but I got so much love back from them. And the word they kept using was energy, that the writing had energy, and also fluency, Greg, because it was truly like I turned on the water. They would come with like 8-line poems, and I'd have 30 pages of prose every week. And I never thought it would be published, Greg. I wasn't writing to be published. But then what happened was, it was February 2020, and it was the beginning of the month, and I checked Susan Miller's Astrology Zone, and she said, oh, my God, this is going to be the greatest month. And sometimes when I hear things like that, I think I have to take a risk because the stars are good, you know? So I had met Jonathan Galassi, who was the president of Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I think probably one of the greatest editors in the world at that moment. I had met him because I had made an opera out of the poet Frank Baddour's poem, Ellen West, and that was published by Jonathan. So there was a Pulitzer dinner. Frank won the Pulitzer Prize, and I was seated next to Jonathan, and we really got along. So I just thought, I'm going to just take a chance. And I sent Jonathan 2 chapters with a little note saying, this may be ridiculous, and you don't even have to read this, but I just felt like I had to send it. I will say, Jonathan, I don't think you've probably read another composer memoir like this. And he
Fair
wrote
enough.
Back, Greg. Yes. And he wrote back right away, and he said, there's definitely something here. And he offered a suggestion, which was, just keep going. Don't look back. There's clearly a fluency. Just keep putting it down and let it find its own shape. And then he said, I want to send you a book we just published, which was John Giorno, the beat poet. It was his new autobiography. And I read that book, and about 2 weeks later, I wrote back to Jonathan with my little book review of that book, and then I sent him 2 more sections. And he wrote me back about an hour later, and he said, I've read everything you've sent me now, and I want to work with you on this book. Call me in the morning and let's talk, T-A-W-K, he wrote. And he said, do you have a literary agent? And really, Greg, the next day, I suddenly had a literary agent who... Her name is Lori List. She's Rachel Maddow's literary agent. She's like really a powerhouse. And I suddenly had a book contract with an advance. I mean, I was on, unemployment. So it was all sort of miraculous. And you can just imagine how my group felt, that I was the total nobody writer in the group and suddenly had this major book deal in advance. They were like, are you kidding me?
You know, it's interesting. That is such an interesting, it's an interesting reversal of many stories you tell in your book, where you see the great success of a counterpart or a colleague, like an Adam Gettle earning some great honor or something, and you are so honest about your own sense of insecurity and vulnerability in those moments, and you are open and honest about just plain old envy, something most of us feel at many points in our lives. You have this way of being open about even those parts of who you are. And I think that's part of what makes this book so exceptional.
Oh, I appreciate that. That was the thing about it. It was an exorcism, Greg. It was like, by sort of eviscerating myself in that way, in the presence of these people I admire and love, I felt so cleansed. And then I was terrified about it being published. I remember one night, it was one of the first nights Kevin and I went out after the, you know, when you were finally allowed to go somewhere. And we went to the Met, you know, and there was a long line. You had to get online and show all your vaccine documents and wear a mask. And I mean, it was intense. And we're sitting at the Met, and I remember seeing Heidi Wailson walking down the aisle, who's the, you know, music critic for the Wall Street Journal, and just thinking, oh my God, these people are going to know things about me that, like, you know, it felt terrifying. But once it was in the world, and I am grateful, it has gotten some wonderful response, because I did think, if this book is universally trashed, it's going to be painful, because it's not music, it's not abstract, it's me.
Yeah.
And if you hate the book, in some ways, it feels like you hate me. So, but it didn't go that way. And now I feel, and I was thinking about this before you called me, which was, I feel known, Greg, in a way that feels like a relief. Because being a composer, your work is constantly judged. You're revered. You're reviled, but you don't really have recourse. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can't write a critic and say, that was stupid, you didn't get it, you know? But in my book, I can say, this is who I am, and this is what's in the notes, and this is what's in the words, and you either get it or you don't get it, but it allowed me to speak in a way that I felt I never have spoken like that before. And at least now, if you are drawn to my work and you read that book, you know what made it. You know what went into the notes. You know a lot more about me. Not everything, because there's a book too, but you know a lot.
Yeah.
And so it's cathartic.
We're speaking with Ricky Ian Gordon about his newly published memoir called Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera. It is a no-holds-barred revelation of who he is, of his life's journey through a challenging childhood, through a complicated family, through his loves, and many of the loves that he has lost over the years. And, of course, there's much in here as well about his process as an artist and as a composer. I don't think we'll have very much time to talk about your family, but I do want to ask you, I mean, first of all, you write extensively about your difficult relationship with your father, saying at one point, there was no entry point for me into my father. You were so different from each other, and much of your personal struggles over the years have in many ways sprung from that. But I actually would rather ask you about a fascinating thing you say about your mother, another complicated person with whom you had, I think it's fair to say, a much more affectionate, if sometimes complicated, relationship.
Yeah.
Your mother was talented in music and talented as a singer. And you tell us at one point that the moment you heard her sing, I recognized her. My mother became genuine with her when she sang. Tell us just a little bit more about that. I find that to be such a fascinating observation.
Well, my mother had been a singer and a comedian in the Borscht Belt. So in a lot of ways, growing up, before I discovered, we were her audience, you know what I mean? Like, she had been a star at 15, and she gave all that up to become a mother. But when I heard her sing, it wasn't funny. She was no longer, it wasn't comedic. It was, and I try to describe it in the book, it was like the voice of diaspora, the voice of, you know, the Jewish heritage from the beginning of time, the voice of, you know, Rachel in the Bible. She was weeping and would not be comforted. It was so deep and so other, like, And it would shock everyone because people in the neighborhood, they would sit around at the beach and they would record my mother telling jokes. And when Don Katz wrote that book about my family home fires, he obtained some of those recordings. But when she sang, it was not funny unless she wanted it to be. It was deeply connected, very moving. And the truth is, Greg, it's what every singer I know wants, a kind of connectedness, communicability, and range. She could sing anything she wanted to sing. She was just a remarkable talent, and so clearly the inspiration for my writing for The Voice.
Hmm. And of course,
in the end, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No,
please.
And of course, the fact that she, at least to a large extent, gave up a life she might have had as a performer, that was a pain that was with her really for the rest of her life.
Yes, and the other thing, you know, Greg, it's very strange, and I do mention this in the book, but my sister Susan, who was a very well-known writer, she was at work on a memoir for Farrar, Straus & Giroux when her addiction to drugs became so unmanageable she couldn't write it. And I remember reading sections from it when I was a kid, and it was brilliant. And it's so strange that in the end, I'm the one that wrote the memoir for Farrar, Straus & Giroux.
Hmm. Interesting.
The whole journey, you know, we just don't, it's like that thing, there's so much happening in the world behind the world that we don't know.
Right, exactly. You're,
it makes life so rich.
Absolutely. Your subtitle mentions opera, but and you become fascinated with opera very early on, especially thanks to a piano teacher who gives you a copy of the venerable Victor book of opera that many of us have on our shelf, and it opened up for you an extraordinary world that you would explore for years and years. You write, "I don't know what it was that so transfixed me, but I was a different person within the hour. My axis had shifted. The tectonic plates of what my life was supposed to be were altered radically." But what I want to ask you about, actually, is the fact that it was not just opera that fascinated you as a young person. You devote one of the most remarkable chapters in your book to the great Joni Mitchell and your ferocious obsession with her, culminating in a remarkable event that occurred at Carnegie Hall. I wonder if you would mind sharing with our listeners the story, you know, first of all, of this obsession with Joni Mitchell and this concert she was going to give at Carnegie Hall that you had to attend.
Well, you know, it starts with my sister Susan wrote the first article about Joni Mitchell in the New York Times. It was a big article, and I was a boy, and she said, "Ricky," she was living in California, "you have to hear the music of this songwriter, Joni Mitchell." And I worshipped my sister, so I would do anything she told me. Soon after that, my sister Lorraine took me and my four-year-old niece Maggie to see the movie Alice's Restaurant. And in that movie, a speed freak dies in an accident on his motorcycle. And at the funeral, this blonde woman, not Joni Mitchell, but a woman with a guitar, comes out and starts singing a song. I knew from the first chord, I was like, that has to be Joni Mitchell. Because why would my sister tell me to listen to her? I was already listening to, you know, Bartok and Stravinsky. And so it was the song, Songs to Aging Children Come. And I remember I went and bought Song to a Seagull and Clouds. And that was it. I was so obsessed with her, I couldn't stop thinking about her. I got her address from my sister. I would send her gifts and letters, and she wrote me back. I have a framed letter for her over my piano. And finally, she was going to be making her Carnegie Hall debut, and I made her a dress. I was, at the time, a master embroiderer. And I had my friend Denise make Joni Mitchell a dress in the size. My sister Susan said she's exactly my size. So we made her, and I embroidered it from head to toe with sunsets, flowers, butterflies, bees. And I wrapped it in brown paper, and I painted her on the package. And the sad part of the story, but it does work out in the end, was that I woke up at 4 in the morning in Long Island, and I took the train to the city, and I was the first one on the line to buy tickets because I wanted the front row center seat. And when I got up to the box office, the woman, like, sort of knew my type, pulled out the ticket, and I handed her the check my mother had given me. And the woman said, "Honey, we don't take checks." I was like, "What?" She said, "No, we don't take checks." I said, "But I don't have any cash. This is all my mother gave me." She said, "I'm sorry." So it was National Bank of North America. I had to run around the city, find a National Bank of North America, have them call my mother and issue me the cash. But by the time I got back to the box office, of course, that ticket was gone, and I was in the back of a long line. It was like the biggest tragedy that had ever befallen me at that moment.
You write, I just want to write, you wrote, "I was heartbroken, shattered, and lost. I wept, bit my nails, and ground my teeth feverishly until I got up to the ticket booth again. The same gravel-faced gargoyle who seemed hell-bent on ruining my life stared out at me with contempt and antipathy. I wish I could say she had kindly put the front row center seat aside for me and was waiting for me to come back, but she almost seemed to relish my misfortune." I wonder if she really did. I have a feeling you were seeing events through a certain sour-tinged lens. But
yes. Yes, I mean, whatever, it was so horrible. But then what happened was my friend Jody Siegel, who was behind me on that line and unfortunately didn't have enough cash to buy my ticket, she got that seat. So on the night of the concert, I went and said, "Jody, I'm sitting with you in that seat." And we split the seat. We were sitting next to Neil Young. And at a certain point in the concert, Joni Mitchell was tuning her dulcimer. And I walked up to the stage and said, "Joni, I'm Ricky." And she said, "Ricky Gordon, my old pen pal." And, of course, everyone I knew in the world that was there started screaming. And she gave me, I pushed the dress onto the stage, and I said, "I made you a present." And she said, "I love things you make yourself," which she had said in the letter, too. And then, you know, I wish I could say she opened the dress on stage, she put it on, blah, blah, blah. I never heard about that dress again. But it makes a good story.
It's an amazing story.
Right? And I was upset with her for a long time, but it waned as she became less of a solo artist and more of a collaborator. Because, as I say in the book, suddenly there were too many people in the room. We weren't just boyfriend and girlfriend. We were like in a crowded room, and her appeal lessened for me. Not until later did I start getting into some of her later work. But, you know, it was first love. You can only have first love once.
Absolutely. And you write.
You
write, "Joni Mitchell is a magnificent artist entitled to as many phases as she likes. Who am I to judge which of these stages was meaningful or produced better art? But I am writing here about me as well. My tastes, my aesthetic, in many ways were shaped by her and by all the other artists I loved. But we change. Our tastes change. Our needs change. Our friends change. Joni was back. She was great. She just wasn't my best friend anymore." It's so interesting to think about the relationship that we have, even with someone whom we've never, in fact, met face-to-face. And yet we often forge with them an incredibly powerful bond. And that bond can really change over the years as they change and we change. And what is between us changes.
That one thing I love, Greg, is the way that story ends. Because it ends in the book with, later on in my life, Stephen Holden, who's the critic for the New York Times, becomes a real fan of my work, and he writes a lot about Judy Collins. So he told Judy she needed to hear my music. And I send, and Judy Collins is who made Joni Mitchell famous with her singing Both Sides Now. So I send Judy Collins a bunch of my songs. She goes crazy, and the next thing I know, she's singing my song A Horse with Wings, and she invites Kevin and I to the Carlisle, and we're there that night, and she's singing A Horse with Wings to, like, Phil Donahue and Marlo Thomas and Candice Bergen. And I'm just thinking, I just can't believe this. You know what I mean? Like, the circularity of life is so, it was so moving. And that's sort of, I feel like that illustrates my life. And
of course.
Going back to the, we just don't know.
Right, you're right. How magical, generous, and utterly unpredictable life is. We're speaking with Ricky Ian Gordon about his marvelous memoir called Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera. Well, of course, as the subtitle suggests, your book is about a lot more than music. It is also about many sexual encounters you had and some drug use as well. And you managed to survive both. And of course,
yes,
it is no small matter that you survived, because of course, one of the things is that you came of age during the massive tragedy of AIDS. One of the intriguing things you say in the chapter devoted to those terrible, terrible years of such massive loss and sorrow is that your own confusion about who you are, at that point in time, your confusion about who you were, let's say, may be why you are still alive, why you managed to survive. Can you just briefly explain that notion of your own confusion, in a sense, perhaps inadvertently saving you from being one more victim of that terrible plague?
Well, because obviously part of what that plague came out of was a kind of sexual liberation. And a lot of my friends were, they were having sex in public places or back rooms or bathhouses. And my confusion made me a chicken. Like, I was afraid to do any of that. And so without knowing what I was sparing myself from, and actually even I had such self-hatred about it, I thought, everyone's having all this fun, and you're, like, just staying at home. But it saved me, because that's, you know, it was a moment where you either went with the flow or you hid. And by hiding, and obviously, too, without getting graphic, there were sexual practices that were not my preference. And because of that, I wasn't doing all the risky behavior. And, of course, then I ended up writing music for the first safe sex porn film for the gay men's health crisis. So it's just weird, Greg. It's the whole thing of how I made it through that time. I mean, by the time I get to Jeffrey and I'm finally, everyone else has died, and now I'm madly in love with someone who's HIV positive, and I basically nurse him out of the world. I mean, I write him an opera of the Tibetan Book of the Dead because he wants to die as a Buddhist. And I basically, we were assigned, I mean, without, you know, glossing it over, people like me were just told, like, kill your lover. I mean, just make them comfortable, which was a metaphor for help them leave the world.
Right. And of course, one of the things that was remarkable about your relationship is that I think it was at the end of your very first date that he announced to you that he was HIV positive. And yet, of course, you already knew you had powerful feelings for him and, of course, stayed the course. One thing you say in this beautiful chapter about your relationship with Jeffrey and your love for him, his love for you, you write, he took me to a version of myself I never knew existed. Can you summarize what that new version of Ricky Ian Gordon was? I mean, what your love for Jeffrey and his love for you, the way in which it transformed you as a person.
Yes. Well, so it must be said that in 1989, I got sober. I got clean and sober. I stopped drinking. I stopped taking drugs. And I met Jeffrey in AA. And what happened was, you know, when you get sober in recovery, it is service that keeps you sober. And as a drunk and a drug addict, I would say I was a hedonist, you know, and my day grew towards alcohol and drugs the way flowers grow towards the sun, you know. So to suddenly be sober, and this man that I can't even describe my initial feelings about him, they were so intense. It was like I definitely knew him from somewhere, like France in the, you know, 1870s or something like that. And he said that. He said, I'm HIV positive, and he looked so sad. And I thought, wow, this is like Iphigenia, you know, when she knows her sacrifice by Agamemnon is going to give her life purpose and meaning. I felt like, okay, I'm going to love him right out of this world, and that's going to give my life purpose and meaning. And it did. I completely transcended the part of myself that was selfish and hedonistic. I just loved him. I mean, literally, he really floated out of this world on a cloud of love. It was just so intense. And I mean, writing him that opera, I literally wrote the aria that he was supposed to die to, and all that happened was the morning he was in my arms, and I couldn't play the recording that he was supposed to hear, so I just sang it myself. But that was a really, I don't think many people have that experience. It was like basically living in an emergency room for a very long time.
Hmm.
So...
Does that
explain it?
It very much does. And, of course, we also learn a great deal about what the two of you shared, but also the ways in which the two of you were very much different from each other. In fact,
yes.
At one point in this chapter, you say, I'm not sure how much Jeffrey and I had in common. And this was something that, from time to time, would be maybe a source of some nervousness or concern for you, that you... I mean, you're not the way some couples are, in which you're just completely on the same wavelength, sharing exactly the same loves and obsessions,
right,
and so on. And yet there was this powerful, unbreakable bond, and in so many ways, a bond that was still there even after Jeffrey's untimely death.
It's still there, yes. It was, that's it's not an exaggeration, though it sounds like something one might roll their eyes at, but he was definitely an angel. And if God had decided you need to grow deeper for what you want to do in your life, because I knew what I wanted to do. I always knew what I wanted to do. I want to be a great artist. And it's like God said, well, then... here's someone to take you to that part of yourself.
Mm.
And he did. Mm. I did not, until the moment Jeffrey died, grief was simply a word in the G section of the dictionary. I had no idea what it meant. And suddenly I was plunged into the most violent foreign country. And I could barely speak to anyone. It was so violent. I mean, I just cried for 5 years straight.
Mm.
But I really feel like that's when I became the composer I was supposed to be.
Right. And I do want to mention that you also write so beautifully and at length about the man with whom you share your life now, Kevin.
Yes,
and
Kevin.
And that relationship is a very, very different one, and very different from, you know, nearly all the other relationships you talk about in your book. In fact, you just go so far as to say that it was simply a different kind of love. And you write, when you are young, you think chemistry is everything. Everything hinges on how attracted you are to someone, how much you want to sleep with them. As you get older,
yes,
you start to want to replace the hysteria of young passion with trust, serenity, reliability, a love that is deeper and more meaningful. And that's what you talk about in terms of this love you have for Kevin and that he has for love, that he has for you. Nothing addictive or obsessive about it, which at first scared you because you said, I thought obsession meant love. You've learned of a different kind of love.
Yes, and I knew it was, I would hug Kevin, and that his body, it's sort of a chemistry thing, but his body gives off a lot of heat. And whenever I would hug him, I felt safe in the world. And even before our first date, maybe even years, I was like, I'm going to end up with him. I just knew it because I felt the kind of safety and comfort with him that was so new to me. And yeah, Kevin Doyle from Ohio is like, just who knew? And that is exactly what it's like. It's you just, and you know, one thing is the obsession thing and the chemistry thing. Usually what it means is I'm going to try to heal with this person the biggest wounds that exists in me. You're usually just trying to heal something that can't be healed with another person. I mean, they say in recovery, you know, you come into the program with a God-sized hole, and the only thing that can fill that hole is God. And not to get all religious, but I was using one obsession after another that they were going to be my higher power. They were going to save me. And if it didn't look like that way, I wanted to jump out the window for every one of them. They all grew to the same intensity. And then I'd end up in these romantic obsession meetings. I just was so damaging. And finally, with Kevin, and I had, by the way, just to say, when I got involved with Kevin, I was still obsessed with another guy, a viola player who had played on my CD, Bright Eyed Joy. And I remember my therapist saying, because Kevin was working for Condé Nast Traveler at the time, and we were traveling all over the world. My therapist said, with Michael, you end up in a fetal position on your bed, howling in pain. And with Kevin, you've been in Thailand, Turkey, Vietnam, Laos. It was like, yes, I saw it. I just saw I have to choose happiness, and I have to choose someone who's going to make my life bigger than someone who's just going to roll me up in a ball.
Mm. Very well put. You write so beautifully about all of these matters, and I'm so appreciative of this aspect of your memoir. And, of course, there is the matter of music, and we just have a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask you about such an interesting moment that you talk about in your chapter devoted to your studies at Carnegie Mellon, because this is the moment where you decide that you want to be a composer, and you actually end up having three different majors at Carnegie Mellon, but you write so intriguingly about what seems to drive you towards becoming a composer, and it is partly your obsession with Stephen Sondheim's Follies. You wrote, I ache to express the same brokenness, derision, and disappointment he expressed in that, or Ingmar Bergman expressed in all of his movies. I wanted to be the music, not just play the music. I wanted to make something great, profound, and moving. Being a pianist felt wrong. That was such an important moment for you, and you say it's, aside from getting sober, probably the single most important decision of your life.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And part, some of the catalysts was that there was a blind pianist at Carnegie Mellon. Her name was Lynn. And she loved Shostakovich, and so did I. She called him Shosty. If you said, oh, I love, you know, the third movement of the 10th Symphony, she'd sit down on the piano and start playing it. And I thought, it just occurred to me that the reason I played the piano was not to perfect a Chopin nocturne, my hands were the instruments through which I explored all the music I loved. And I would, you know, there was the Boosie and Hawks factory was very close to our house, and I would go there and get scores. I knew so much music by the time I was at Carnegie Mellon, and I suddenly thought, maybe I'm a composer. And I just went to the music department and said, what do I have to do to transfer into the composition department? And they said, write music. So I went home for a vacation, and it was a little bit like writing this book, Greg. Like, it was the same thing. I opened a tap, and suddenly, and my father was astounded because he always had this story about me that I was lazy. Suddenly, within like 2 weeks, I wrote like 100 pages of music. And, of course, I got right into the composition department, and the rest is history with a little detour into acting.
Right, exactly. Well, and of course, everything has served the story and been part of the story.
Yeah.
And of course, at one point, you write very early in the book, music is the cause of most of the joy in life, as well as much of my unhappiness. Sometimes it is a bed of nails, at others, a field of clouds. Well, we taste all of that and more in your remarkable memoir called Seeing Through, A Chronicle of Sex, Drugs, and Opera, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and the author, Ricky Ian Gordon. Ricky Ian Gordon, I thank you so much for giving the world this absolutely fascinating and engrossing memoir. It is illuminating in every sense of the word, and I so appreciate this opportunity to speak with you about it. Thank you so much, and very best wishes.
Thank you, Greg. The same to you.
And you can hear more from composer Ricky Ian Gordon on Monday's morning show, as we expand our conversation to talk about some of his most noteworthy works for the stage and about his creative process. So that's coming up on Monday on The Morning Show. Looking ahead to more of our morning show schedule for next week, I hope you'll make a special point of joining me for Tuesday's morning show, when you'll hear the interview I've just recorded with William Cope Moyers. He is a vice president with the Hazelton Betty Ford Foundation, and he has written a memoir called Broken Up, which tells the latest story in his long journey towards recovery and sobriety from years of addiction. William Moyers is coming to southeastern Wisconsin to be one of the keynote speakers of the 15th annual Help and Hope Conference on Substance Use Disorders. And he will have a book signing for his new memoir, Broken Open, at Blue House Books in downtown Kenosha the night before. And again, you can hear my newly recorded interview with William Cope Moyers on Tuesday. And by the way, on the Sunday podcast version of The Morning Show, I'm sharing out of the archives two previous interviews I recorded with William Cope Moyers, including a conversation from way back in 2007 upon the publication of his best-selling first memoir, Broken. Next Wednesday, Herschel Kruger joins me from the theater faculty at Carthage College. He'll be here with Ali Viterbi to talk about the play Life Cycle of a Star. We'll also be previewing the next concert of the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra on Wednesday's morning show. Next week, we will also be talking about the Racine Theatre Guild's production of Little Women, which actually opens tonight, but we will not be able to share a conversation with director Lisa Konetsky until a week from today. Also, a look at a big gala concert coming up at St. Mary's Lutheran Church as they celebrate their 150th anniversary. A busy, busy week on The Morning Show. It airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And you can subscribe to the podcast version of The Morning Show to hear a different morning show 7 days a week by looking for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Clouds this morning will give way to sunshine this afternoon. We're headed for a high of 62 degrees. We'll have an overnight low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny and seasonal with a high of 56 degrees. Back up into the 60s for a daytime high on Sunday and Monday. And we'll actually see the upper 70s the middle of next week. This is WGTD HD.